backup. That a meeting like this would normally be perceived from the outside as a meeting of a council of the elders of Zion. And part of the signs of the times is the elders of Zion have become the elderesses of Zion. Thank God, in very happy proportion. I thought it would be useful to share with you some background about Billy Graham, his relationship to Israel, the Jewish community, and in particular, a mission which he is about to embark on in the Soviet Union. I don't know how many of you saw a story in Newsweek magazine about a week ago, which is fairly accurate, which describes something about his forthcoming mission to Moscow. I'll come back to that in a few moments. It is a mission which is potentially of considerable significance to the Jewish community there, and the whole issue of Jewish emigration from the Soviet Union, and the relationship of Billy Graham to Israel. I think, as many of you know, the general images of Dr. Graham in the media range from those in the conservative press of that of adulation to that of mimicry, and worse in much of the liberal secular press. I mean, the very image of a born-again Christian, of an evangelical Christian, has led to all kinds of stereotypes, and I think it's important for us, in terms of the very profound concerns that Jews have, particularly at this moment in the life of America and in the international community, with all of the pressures we feel, to separate out those caricatures and stereotypes from some fact and reality as we've experienced them over recent years. I'm not interested in a whitewash. I'm not a front man for Billy Graham. I'm not on his payroll. He couldn't afford me anyway. But my point of departure, and I think the point of departure of the American Jewish Committee, to say it in as brief way as I can, is that of what is good for the Jews in this situation. I began my relationship with Dr. Graham roughly around 1965, when, after traveling through the South, I began to experience the enormous transformation that was taking place in the South, the whole sociological transformation of the evangelical community, from rednecks, as they were perceived, Bible thumpers, crackers, to a people who had become increasingly middle class, socioeconomically had moved into the mainstream of the South, had begun to achieve major strides in advanced education, and just struck me that the images in which I was raised about evangelical Christians had almost no relationship to the reality that I began to experience in the South. Beyond that, it began to be clear, roughly in the 1960s, that the fastest growing community in America was that of the evangelical Christian community, who today now number 40 to 50 million Christians. And their growth began to take place at a time when liberal Protestantism, as a result of the civil rights struggle and other concerns, was declining. Now, the Presbyterians lost half their membership, their budget was split in half, the Episcopalians were going through the same kind of devolution. And it became clear to me that somehow we had better begun to understand who these evangelical Christians were. It was out of that world that Jimmy Carter emerged as the first president of the United States, as a born-again Christian, the first president from the evangelical community to seek the presidency, first candidate to seek the presidency in more than 100 years. So Dr. Graham invited me to visit with him at his home in Moncrief, North Carolina, and we spent some 3.5 hours together talking about everything. I want to share with you, not for the record, one of the reasons not for the record is that I'm in the process of writing a book on Billy Graham, The Jews in Israel, with Dr. Graham's permission. He wants me to hold off for a while until the Middle East situation settles down, out of fear of reprisals against Baptists, Southern Baptists in Jordan and elsewhere. Because as a result of that relationship with Dr. Graham since 65, 66, I've gone through some extraordinary experiences with him in relation to Israel, Soviet Jewry, anti-Semitism, and conversion experiences, Jews for Jesus and others. I don't want to share this with you as part of the background of the discussion with Dr. Graham. I'm not sure yet what he wants to get into. We talked briefly in New York on March 10th when he got the Templeton Award. But let me tell you this, that after the 1967 war, in fact, during the 1967 war, that was the first time it happened, especially in the 1973 war, Graham played a decisive and unreported role in relation to winning support in the White House for Israel. He had an intimate friendship with Golda Meir. Golda Meir never came to the United States without calling him or seeing him. And the reason for it is several-fold. In fact, I should say, tell you by way of anecdote, when I visited with him subsequently at his home in 1973 during the Key 73 campaign, he took me into his library where we sat down to talk, and we were talking about his theological views about Judaism and the Jewish people. He went to the library and pulled out a black Bible, Jerusalem Bible, opened it up, and said, "To my dear friend Billy, signed Golda." That friendship grew out of the fact that when Israel was in need of military aid in 1967, Billy Graham quietly, privately made interventions with the President of the United States at a time when almost no one else was able to reach the President. During the During the 1973 war, some of you may have read Kissinger's memoirs recently in Time magazine regarding the debate that took place in the cabinet after the third and fourth day of the 73 Yom Kippur War, when a conflict broke out between James Schlesinger and Kissinger as to the provision of supplies to Israel. By the fourth day of the war, Israel was virtually without any missiles to counter the Egyptian attack that had begun to successfully take place across the Suez Canal. Kissinger was playing his typical game of Weltpolitik. Israel should be helped enough to win, but not win big. Egypt should be helped enough to counter Israel, but not to be able to defeat Israel. And for 2 days, there was a stalemate between Kissinger and Schlesinger as to whether or not missiles should be made available to Israel on an emergency airlift basis. And there was no resolution of that conflict. And the Israelis began to panic. They were totally unprepared for the war. Golda Meir had tried to reach Nixon and could not get through. Several Jewish leaders, including Max Fischer and others, tried to get to see Nixon, and Nixon refused to see them for 2 days, 3 days. I got a call on the fourth day from Simcha Dennis at midnight at my home. Golda Meir is trying to reach Billy Graham, and we can't get him at his home. Do you know where he is? So I contacted one of the aides of Billy Graham, who's close to us, who may be with him today, and I told him the urgency, and I got the telephone number of Billy Graham. I got to Simcha Dennis, and during the night, Golda Meir reached Billy Graham and begged him to contact Nixon to tell him how critical it was for Israel to get those missiles within 24 hours, or Israel may very well be defeated. That's how massive the onslaught came from Egypt. By that time, Israel had already lost 2,000 soldiers, the equivalent of 150,000 soldiers relative to America's population. President Nixon had left instructions after he became president that when Billy Graham calls the White House switchboard, he's to be put through directly to him. And if Nixon is not available, he is to have direct access to Henry Kissinger. Billy Graham, after talking with Golda Meir and feeling the urgency of that situation, called Nixon immediately, pleaded with him to resolve the conflict between Kissinger and Schlesinger, and said that God will judge you as to how you respond to Israel in its hour of need. If God forbid, if anything should happen to Israel, you will have to bear the responsibility before the Lord for failing the Jewish people in their hour of need. Kissinger owns up only to the fact that the conflict was resolved and that Nixon made the decision for the missiles to go. And the next morning, the biggest airlift in the history of America, military history, was undertaken, larger by four times than that of the Berlin airlift. And planes left airfields out of Virginia around the clock with missiles and other military equipment, which reached Israel within the next 24, 48 hours. And if you talk to Simcha Dennis, who was at the center of that whole operation, he will tell you that literally Billy Graham was the key to Israel's survival on the 73 war. Israeli officialdom that knows about this, Teddy Kollek regards himself as one of the closest friends of Graham. He invited Graham to come there to spend a year in Mishkanot Sha'ananim to write a book on Israel from an evangelical perspective, and Graham has accepted in principle, has not worked that out. After the 67 war, when it became clear that there was so much confusion, especially in the liberal Protestant community, not a single Protestant leader spoke out in support of Israel's defense of itself in the 67 war when it was surrounded. In fact, a sense of outrage developed in the Jewish community, and many rabbis, several of whom distinguished rabbis here, can attest to this. In the wake of the silence and worse that came from liberal Protestant leaders, and I'm not here playing a game of conservative Protestants versus liberal Protestants, simply a matter of the fact of the situation. When a man like Dr. Henry Pitt Van Dusen, who was the former president of Union Theological Seminary, the major Protestant interdenominational seminary, literally the week after Israel's striking victory, the 67 war, wrote a letter to the New York Times, which is one of the great moral obscenities of this generation, in which he likened Israel's victory to that of a Nazi blitzkrieg cutting through the poor Arab world mercilessly, saying nothing about the assault of five Arab countries who set out to destroy Israel. And reverberations of Pitt Van Dusen's sentiments began to go through the whole liberal Protestant community. We set up a meeting for a group of liberal Protestant leaders shortly thereafter, because Pitt Van Dusen's line began to become the catchword among liberal Protestant hierarchy. And we arranged the meeting at which Rabbi Heschel, Olav HaShalom, spoke and others. Billy Graham became so concerned about this wave of reaction among many Christians, especially liberal Christians, who somehow could understand Israel as a victim, but could not cope with the image of Israel as a victor, defending itself. And Graham commissioned his people, the Billy Graham Film Association, to do a film called His Land. He invested $500,000 in that film. It is one of the most beautiful films about Israel. If you have not seen it, you should see it. It's a love poem done from an evangelical perspective with Cliff Barrows, one of his aides, walking through all of Israel with a Bible in his hand and relating the prophecies of Isaiah and Jeremiah to the actual land experience as they walked through the countryside. It was an evangelical film. After I'd seen it, I thought it was so beautiful, but the first version of it was, in fact, the evangelical film whose purpose was to climax with a Christian appeal for conversion to Christianity. It was done tastefully, but I said to Billy, I can't sell that. That's not going to go. It's not going to float in my circles, Billy. So I said, maybe we need another ending for the general audience, and we need one for our own community. So he produced two endings to His Land, evangelical and others. The film His Land continues to be shown in evangelical churches. On an average Sunday, for example, the First Baptist Church in Houston, Texas, 4,000 people have come to see that film and have responded to it with a rising standing ovation. It's led to all kinds of activities, groups of tours, etc. I don't want to go much greater detail other than to tell these rather dramatic episodes. I can tell you stories of how he helped me get some families out of the Soviet Union. Ruth Alexandrovich, who was in Putna prison, a 23-year-old nurse who literally was on the verge of dying from nephritis and asthma. She was in prison for 3 years. The sin was the KGB caught her purchasing a Bible on the black market. And I brought her mother to see Graham in Chicago on a Sunday. And Graham got on the telephone and reached Kissinger. Within 3 months, she was released from prison and was brought to Israel. Graham's taken stands against anti-Semitism in very powerful ways from a religious perspective. He's taken stands against the PLO and terrorism. When we gave him our first interreligious award in Atlanta 3 years ago, made a magnificent speech. A lot of people came doubting, skeptical. When he finished his statement on his attitude toward Jews and Judaism, speaking of God's permanent election of the Jewish people, a covenant in the Bible, and taking a stand again against anti-Semitism and prejudice, and then against the terrorism and the violence of the PLO, he got a standing ovation from all of our leadership. I just want to conclude by, and I hope we now get a chance to do some discussion about some of these concerns that you might have. He will be in Moscow on May 9th. He was invited by the Patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church, Archbishop Piman, to take part in a conference on nuclear disarmament and the survival of the human race. As some of you may know, Graham, in recent years, has made that his central moral issue, because he believes what is at stake here is the very survival of human life, as indeed I believe it is a central question of our time. There's been very great pressure against him from the White House and the State Department not to go, because there is fear that the Soviets are going to use him for their propaganda purposes. And the pressure has been formidable. I saw it when I was with him at the UN on March 10th, when he got the Templeton Award, when it was announced, and a representative of the State Department came in of ambassadorial rank and pleaded with him in my presence across the table to change his mind. Well, Graham has decided to go. For him spiritually, religiously, it is the climax, the capstone of his career. It's the only country in the world he has not preached thus far. In the morning after we finished at a press conference, which I was invited to address as a response to his getting the Templeton Award, he took me aside and said, I want to get your advice about whether you think it'll be helpful or not for me to meet with representatives of the Jewish community in Russia, in Moscow. We had that discussion several times before he went to Hungary and before he went to Poland, Auschwitz. And in each case, I counseled them to meet with Jewish leaders because he was meeting with all other religious groups. And my sense of the situation was that if he goes to Hungary and meets with Orthodox and Catholics and Baptists and Pentecostals and doesn't meet with Jews, that will be a message to that repressive government that Jews don't count in the international scheme of things. And Graham shared that conviction. He went, and I arranged for him to meet with the leadership of the Hungarian community. It was an incredibly moving experience. He learned for the first time the magnitude of the suffering of Jews in Hungary. And they sat together after they spoke, they held hands, they prayed together, and they all began to cry like babies. And to them, it was one of the most moving experiences, as the head of the seminary wrote to me, because for a person of Graham's standing, in a sense, to risk the success of his tour by identifying with the Jewish community, which is a minority community, well, now he's prepared to do the same thing when he goes to the Soviet Union. And we're going to spend some time together. He's asked me to review with him the situation of Jews there, to give him some background on whom to meet with when he gets there, and to arrange for him to meet with appropriate Jewish religious and dissident representatives while he's there. So I'm sure that all of that will come out in the discussion today. Believe me, these are representative of the facts of some of the things that have going on. I'm not booming Billy Graham for the chief rabbi of the American Jewish community. But I think it is important for us to know, in a world in which, in the United Nations, there is an effort to isolate Israel as the pariah among the nations, in a country where presidents speak about dual loyalty with a view toward isolating Jews from the mainstream of America, we don't play games and trivialize relationships of people who reach out hands of friendship, whatever their motivation, and dismiss that as inconsequential. And I take the intention of Dr. Graham, as well as the extraordinary record of friendship, not just in terms of speeches and intention, but demonstration at a time when it really counted, to be a fact of supreme importance to us. And for him to undertake during this trip, which will get tremendous attention everywhere, to consider wanting to go to the Moscow synagogue, to consider wanting to meet with Sharansky's mother with a view to trying to save his life, as being an act of not only friendship, but indeed of great moral courage. And it's against that background that I hope we'll consider our meeting with Dr. Graham today. I've already gone too long, but I hope we can talk about anything that's on your mind before he comes in.
Thank you, Mark. Because we have so many representatives here, and I will ask you to do the same thing when Dr. Graham comes, would you introduce yourself when you are called upon to speak? And Ruth, I saw your hand first.
Ruth Fine, who is head of Combined Jewish Philanthropy.
Every subject you mentioned, and you said some very wonderful glowing things about Dr. Graham, and it's clear that his relationship with Israel and his conservative of Jewry is genuinely very strong. You did not mention at all any domestic issues or any relationship between the evangelical community and the American Jewish community, and I wonder whether you're suggesting that this is not, these are not subjects that we ought to discuss.
No, I'm not suggesting that. I am concerned about the time that we have together with him. We have exactly an hour. His schedule calls for him to leave here at 4 o'clock for another meeting. I thought in terms of some of our priority concerns, the most pressing concerns, these certainly are foremost among them. I think on the domestic front, he is prepared. I'm not sure how he wants to deal with it, but his concern about anti-Semitism is very real. And he's made a number of statements recently and is prepared to go very far again to deal with that issue. I'm not sure there's much profit getting involved with him in any discussion of Reaganomics and the problems of its implications for the poor and the dispossessed, etc. My sense is that he's a very honest man. And he realizes that having gotten involved more than he cared to or should have with Nixon, he was burned badly. And he will tell you, I will not get involved in that kind of political relationship ever again. And he has, in fact, avoided that kind of political relationship with Ronald Reagan. Reagan has consulted him on a number of issues, but he's avoided getting into that kind of concrete, detailed politics. He is personally, in terms of another domestic issue, not terribly sympathetic with the Morrow Majority and Jerry Falwell, as in evangelical meetings, as our good friend Marvin Wilson may attest, at a meeting of the National Religious Broadcasters Association, carefully, with great sensitivity to the kind of fellowship that exists among evangelical ministers, been very critical of the electronic church and its hustling for money, rather than preaching the gospel as an end in itself, using it as a means to an end frequently. But I think it's the simple question for us, I think, is what do we want to realize in this conversation with him? And I think we ought to be clear about our priorities and not make non-essential or trivial issues central issues where we end up burning away precious time with him. This is the only meeting he is having with Jewish leadership before he goes to Moscow. We may have one meeting with him with a small group on the Soviet Jewry issue, with a National Conference on Soviet Jewry and with Ted Mann and others. Therefore, I hope we would use it to maximum advantage. But no, there are no rules to this game. There are no limits on what one might discuss.
In the letter of introduction, Murray Rotten, in the letter of invitation to this meeting, it was indicated, I don't know if you saw this letter, it was indicated that the purpose of the meeting is twofold. As he brings the Christian crusade to New England, Dr. Graham welcomes the opportunity to meet with Jewish community leaders to clarify what the crusade is and what it is not. Second point, in turn, we want to discuss with him some of our anxieties and concerns with the evangelical movement. Based on your experience, what can you give us by way of background that might be helpful in our discussion with him?
You mean in relation to the crusade?
Right, which were two items which were mentioned in the letter of invitation. And I assume that he will bring them up, or if he doesn't, should we? And if we should, in what way, and what can we expect?
Well, let's see what he has to say about the crusade. I don't know what he plans to say. I do know that some of the people associated with him, the chairman of the crusade, Lawson Svergen, who's a friend of mine, who's president of Commercial Union, happens to be evangelical Christian, is very much concerned that the crusade not get involved in all kinds of controversy. They're very careful, as one has every right to be, that there not be attacks on Graham out of left field for trying to evangelize Jews, which is not his purpose, but as a Jewish community, as an entity. I think one ought to feel free to ask him about his attitude toward evangelization in Jews, or Jews for Jesus. In 1973, during the Key 73 campaign, he became very upset about the pressure being brought to bear on Jewish kids at colleges and high schools. And when I went to see him and we talked it through, he issued a statement attacking Jews for Jesus, the Hebrew Christian Alliance, saying that he is opposed to organized efforts and organized bodies to convert the Jews. But I think one ought to ask him that, how he feels about that today. Incidentally, I think his theology of Israel has grown enormously. He has begun to give thought to that in recent years, and when I was with him in 73 and he pulled out the Golda Meir Bible, he began quoting psukim from the Bible to show me how he believes that God's covenant with the Jewish people is permanent. It's not for Christians to substitute for that covenant. We leave to God at the end of the day is what the future destiny of Jews is to be. But there's no reason why not to ask that question in relation to our other concerns.
Thank you.
Will take place here in New England. Our experience with him in the past on the college campuses has been that he's been really perfectly easy to deal with. but the groups, the local groups that support it, get a big thing in the way. Do you know if he has any control over these things? Is it worth talking to him about it?
I think it's an important question to ask.
Can you hear?
No.
No, I think he knows.
Yeah. We're going to get the air conditioning turned down also.
Why is this right over there?
Could you, the question was that Dr. Graham, on the college campuses, has been very easy to work with, but the groups that he has worked with have been very difficult.
The local evangelical groups on the college campuses themselves have targeted their evangelicism, their missionary efforts for
or the Campus Crusade for Christ. InterVarsity Youth?
InterVarsity more than Campus Crusade.
Well, let me tell you what happened in 73. He was very upset at what he saw as emerging out of the Campus Crusade for Christ and InterVarsity Youth, as anti-Semitism. That is to say, when these zealous young evangelicals began going after Jewish young people on college campuses and high schools, and kids refused to respond to their call, they began responding with naked anti-Semitism, stiff-necked Jews, you know, hard-hearted, you know, dying,
exactly
Satan. Graham contacted, first of all, he issued his statement. His statement was sent to the Campus Crusade for Christ and InterVarsity Youth. And after that happened, Bill Bright, who was head of the Campus Crusade for Christ, came to see me, and I laid it out on the table. I said, we're going to hold you accountable for the pressure that your young zealots bring together on Jewish kids, and some of the stories were horrendous, or horror stories. I mean, Crusaders went into Campus Crusade for Christ kids went into Duke University in the dormitory looking for mezuzahs, and they found a mezuzah. They would literally break into a room or come in under false pretenses, questionnaire, that kind of thing, would refuse to leave a room. They would stay till 3 o'clock in the morning until they got a decision for Christ from a Jewish kid. The kids would have to pick them up, throw them out bodily, and it developed into a real conflict. Well, that appalled him. He says that's opposed to everything I think of as a Baptist in terms of freedom of conscience and voluntary consent. And he contacted a number of the missionary groups and told them they've got to discipline their young people. And Bill Bright subsequently called a meeting of his campaign captains and read the riot act to them in terms of how to relate to Jews. And so that pressure began to subside very substantially. And it may well be that if you have the chapter and verse of something like that happening, to raise that. Graham is not bashful in putting that to the people who are running the campaign on the university campuses. And I think it is important to raise that if there are those kinds of pressures developing. And now a statement from him, it may well be that he's prepared to issue another statement in relation to the crusade as he did in 73 in Key 73, and that may very well help and creating the atmospherics which will enable you to talk to the local evangelical, saying this is opposed to what Graham is about. And we may well ask him to do that.
Where is he speaking?
I don't know. You would know better than I.
All over New England. He will be in Hartford, Manchester, Springfield, Boston, New Haven, and Providence, Rhode Island.
Has he been at Dartmouth yet?
I don't know. The crusade is later in April, May, and early June. He will be in the Boston area late May and early June.
Do we have a list of the places? Do we have?
I do have the list.
Let's
I
take
do
a
not
look
have
at that.
It with me.
It may be worthwhile if.
Dickerson Field at Boston University over a series of days. I think almost a week. Every day we give him one.
Yeah, kind of over onto the.
Has it ever been the experience in various communities where they have had these things that the presence of Dr. Graham and the media hype and the activity will energize not only the evangelicals but other groups, perhaps who might be, or individuals? We've had some anti-Semitic incidents here. Has it ever been just the presence of the crusade that would energize these kinds of incidents that we might need to be more vigilant about or prepare the community?
Anti-Semitic groups,
yes.
Fringe groups?
Or individual acts of anti-Semitic.
I have not seen that. What I have seen is that his presence and the challenge that he makes to the churches tends to energize liberal Protestants to become more evangelical. They begin to feel their inadequacy in terms of reaching their own membership, and you find there's much more talk about evangelism among liberal Protestants today than ever in the past because of the success of the evangelical Christians. I have no doubt that groups like Liberty Lobby, if they find a phrase somewhere they can pick up, will pick up and use that. But if there are any anti-Semitic episodes that emerge out of this, I have no question that if that's brought to his attention, that he'll speak to it, and will speak to it during the course of a sermon. He has done this in the past. He did it in Shea Stadium in New York at one time when I brought something to his attention in front of, I don't know, 20,000 people. So he's that open on these kinds of issues and cares that much about this. He wants none of that to be associated with his campaign.
I think I assume that he has a structure of people surrounding him who work with him in his religious activity, does he not?
He can tell the Pentagon how to organize a systems management.
Okay. Do the people he's organized under him, are they preaching the same principles that he's preaching?
Oh, yeah. People, of course, Marvin Wilson knows many of these. I just tell my own, and maybe Marvin, you'd feel free to comment on that. The people I know who are close to him are all raised in his tradition and look to him for the word, the tone, the direction. The counselors are trained in his style.
It's very well orchestrated, very well controlled from their base. And
the people around him are very good friends of ours. Cliff Barrows, T.W. Wilson, Grady Wilson, Sterling Houston. Is Leighton up here too?
No, I said he's, you know, his associate.
Yeah, brother-in-law.
Yes.
A beautiful guy, written marvelous things about Jews and Judaism. But we should raise that. If it comes up in the discussion, I think one ought to feel free to put those questions to him.
Mark, yeah. Do you feel that Dr. Graham is ready to make a positive statement in separating himself from the moral majority in his group?
I doubt, for his own internal political reasons, that he is prepared to take on head-on Gary Falwell and the moral majority. If he had wanted to, he would have done that earlier than now. What he has done is address himself to the issues raised by the moral majority rather than the organization and the personalities. He has attacked several times the yoking together of the evangelical mission with a political party. He said a political party that flies under the colors of evangelism will destroy the evangelical churches of America. And he's been very forthright about that. He's also been very forthright about a lot of manipulation and exploitation that has gone on. And he says there simply is no Christian politics, no evangelical politics that the evangelical group should support. Also, I think part of his intention is, his strength lies in the fact that he is regarded as Mr. Evangelical Christian in America. And he is determined to keep as broad a base of support among mainstream evangelicals. I have my own sense of the situation. There are 40 to 50 million evangelicals in America, probably 30 to at least 30 million of them, by sense I get from talking to people, Southern Baptist Convention, Southern Presbyterian, at least 30 million of them will have nothing to do with the moral majority. Moral majority tends to claim far more than they actually represent, just as they claim far more in terms of their impact on television than the data actually shows. But I doubt whether you may want to ask him the question about the issues that are raised. The notion of, if you don't vote for the Panama Canal, you're a bad Christian. How does he look at that? That's what Falwell's people were saying at one time.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're saying about congressmen and senators on their hit list.
Yeah.
Would you, Dick Kay, I'm the attorney of Boston, would you say a little bit about the distinction between the evangelical Christians and the so-called liberal Christians, by way of background for us, in terms of religious theology?
Marvin, I don't know, you're a privileged person. Gerd Toshav.
Excuse me,
yeah.
Was Marvin introduced when I was out of the room?
Oh.
Professor Marvin Wilson is a dear friend of our community and of the American Jewish Committee. He's a professor of Bible at Jordan College in Wenham, Mass. one of the pioneers, really, from the evangelical Christian community in talking with the Jews about issues of common concern.
He was also co-chairman of our first national conference of evangelicals and Jews, and co-editor with me of a book called Evangelicals and Jews in Conversation, which sells for $7.95.
How much in bonds and all of that? Thank you. I owe a lot to Rabbi Tannenbaum in getting me into this business. It says it's tough days. Just to reply to your question a little bit, evangelical Christians probably historically have put more emphasis upon the proclamation, the preaching, the sharing of the so-called gospel message than liberal Protestants. Liberal Protestants have been probably identified with Jewish people a lot easier because they've been primarily social action people and good works oriented, and have tended to minimize theological creed and maximize the social action. And I think the conscience of evangelicalism in recent years has been pricked in terms of its negligence in terms of the social concerns in these issues. And one of the happy things, and I think Mark can vouch for this, the last 10 years has shown a profound shift to a much more this worldly concern. The Olam Hazeh is indeed as important as the Olam Haba. And I
your evangelical Rabbi. Hebrew is great. Great.
Translate that, Rabbi. This worldly concerns are as important as other worldly concerns. I would say that's one broad difference in terms of emphasis. Graham's interest, for instance, on the nuclear issues and concerns like this is symbolic of this shift which is taking place. Creedally, evangelicals have probably stressed more doctrinal fine points than liberals. They have tended to be at times anti-intellectual, more separatistic from the mainstream of Protestantism. There are other characteristics, some good, some not so good, but these are just, they're found in every mainline denomination, by the way. And there's a national organization called the National Association of Evangelicals to which millions of members of churches, evangelical churches, find their people associating for various kinds of things. But this is where primarily you will find them on the spectrum. Conservative in theology, but a wide spectrum politically.
I get the one other distinction that becomes critical is that evangelicals tend to take the Bible very seriously, believe in biblical inerrancy of the Bible in a way that liberal Protestants do not, who tend to view it far more through the perspective of historical critical scholarship, and therefore its claims are less binding. They tend to look for the inner message far more than looking at the word of the text itself.
Which has a natural built-in support, by the way, for Israel. One of the interesting paradoxes is the strongest supporters of Israel in this country are your evangelical Christians, because when, you know, the Bible says something about God's relation to Israel, we tend to take that seriously. God wasn't stuttering when he said that. And if the Jews are back in their land, though there are many who see this as a fulfillment of some sort of prophetic teaching in the Jewish prophets, yet there are many who want to stress the Jews have a right to the land. And this is one of the messages I'm seeking to stress in my own community, that the right to the land also must be established on what is just, what is right, what is humane, what is expedient for people who are survivors of a terrible Holocaust. And it's these other human concerns that I'm very concerned that we see as our community, that it's more than a biblical issue. It's an issue of humanity and survival, really.
I'm going to suggest that we take a break now, because Dr. Graham ought to be here in about another 5 minutes or so. He's been detained. He's supposed to be at 3. He's gotten tied up with his earlier meeting. And Herman tells me that they're on their way over. So it might be a good idea to take a break now, so then we can have a more intense and undivided session from the time he comes in to the 4 or so.